Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. We have a local news roundup from Kansas City Star covering top news in the region. Over 1,200 deaths in Missouri from fentanyl overdoses and 500 deaths in the metro has created a health crisis for many. The Biden administration moved towards less punitive measures, moving toward prevention by changing the Good Samaritan laws. Then Johnson County Sheriff has a budget and staffing problem, partially due to the QAnon conspiracy theory and ignoring COVID-19 mandates and guidelines during the outbreak of COVID-19. Homicide rising in the Kansas City Metro. City Hall blames anti-snitch culture. Then Governor David Parson plans for a Kansas-type brownback neoliberal policy that will devastate the Missouri state economy. Governor Parsons meets pushback from conservative state government. Drive-by Truckers provide the music soundtrack for the evening live at the Fillmore February 15, 2022. And Highland Community College president is sued in federal court for racist comments and references to Adolf Hitler. 3 staff fired for defending the black athletes. Affordable housing advocates, KC tenants, disagree with City Hall on budget plans for affordable housing. What's inside the $50 million bond for infrastructure? Our internet mashup borders Max Headroom territory. With Oath Keepers' attorney arraigned in federal court, interesting to note they met with Proud Boys the day before January 6th. Also a phone message from the National White People Party in 1975. We'll keep that short. Then Joe Biden's MAGA takedown. Lauren Boebert comments on the Joe Biden speech. Tucker Carlson's mashup of hate speech from Media Matters. We have a frontline clip from Lies, Politics, and Democracy, starting with the Seville connection to January 6th, with segments from Nick Fuentes, Steve Deese, Boogaloo Boys, Christian Nationalists, John Gondalo, Coach Dan Dubemine, Pastor Mark Burns, Steve Peters, Reverend Rodney Howard Brown, Pat Robertson, The Dilly Show, Tyler Russell, and Dalton Coldfetter. Other segments of the mashup comes from Fox News, Newsmax, MSNBC, and CNN. Then analysis of the Hitler-Stalin Pact with Princeton professor Stephen Kotkin. Special thanks to Elm Fork, John Brown Gun Club, One People's Project, ABCF, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee of the IWW, Final Straw Radio, Atlanta Antifa, Nebraska Antifa, Southside Chicago Zine Distro, Crime Think, It's Going Down, Left Coast Right Wing Watch, and Rochester, New York Zine Distro. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
Jailing drug dealers doesn't save lives. KC's opioid epidemic is a health crisis. The face of Ashton Harmon Manzer on a billboard hangs high above a busy strip of Interstate 70 in Kansas City because that's where the 22-year-old died 2 years ago of an accidental overdose of fentanyl. The painkiller oxycodone that he had taken before. The pill was instead laced with fentanyl, an opioid that can stop breathing in seconds.
Next article.
Small wonder Johnson County can't hire new deputies. Can't hire new deputies. Can't hire new deputies. Can't hire new deputies. With election denying sheriff.
Election denying sheriff.
Election denying sheriff.
Election denying sheriff.
Election denying. Johnson County Sheriff Calvin Hayden is scheduled to meet next week with county commissioners to discuss ongoing budget and staffing struggles in his department. We cannot hire deputies fast enough, Hayden told commissioners earlier this year. Officers are quitting because salaries are too low, he said. Cities pay more, with easier work conditions. Mandatory overtime in the sheriff's office isn't helping. Oh, and the media are to blame, too. We've been villainized by the press and a lot of other people, Hayden said in June. Is there another reason? Is it possible Hayden's sometimes bizarre operation of his office has chased public safety workers away? We think the answer could be yes.
Yes, 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 yes.
We also think the Johnson County Commission should consider that possibility before it writes Hayden a big check in the name of county taxpayers. Roughly 60 sheriff's department positions are unfilled in Johnson County. Since deputies guard the jail and take emergency calls, any shortfall is a concern. The jail needs guards.
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 The county wants and needs a functioning sheriff's department. But it isn't clear to us how spending more money will solve the staffing problem as long as Hayden is the county sheriff. Hayden officially invited first responders without COVID-19 vaccinations to work for his department.
Work for his department.
Work for his department.
Next article.
Jailing drug dealers doesn't save lives. KC's opioid epidemic is a health crisis. The face of Ashton Harmon Manzer on a billboard hangs high above a busy strip of Interstate 70 in Kansas City because that's where the 22-year-old died 2 years ago of an accidental overdose of fentanyl. Missouri prosecutors already have the option of charging dealers with murder when the drug they sell kills. But having evidence to support such cases is rare, said Mike Mansour, spokesman for Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker. Mansour could recall only one case, in 2019, in which prosecutors had evidence and charged the Lee Summit man with second-degree murder for selling fentanyl-laced heroin that killed a woman. In 2021, nearly 108,000 people died from drug overdoses, with more than two-thirds involving illegal fentanyl used, often haphazardly, in illicit opioids. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has labeled the rapid rise in deaths from fentanyl overdose the national epidemic.
National epidemic.
National epidemic.
National epidemic. National.
The Drug Enforcement Administration says that in 2021 more Americans died from fentanyl than from cars or guns.
Their guns.
Their guns. In Missouri, 1,375 residents died of opioid overdose in 2020 and 1,275 of those deaths were because of synthetic opioids, of which fentanyl is by far most common. In Jackson County, one in five drug overdose deaths are kids under the age of 15.
The age of 15.
The age of, according to county health
officials.
According to county health
officials.
According to county health
officials. According to county health.
But rather than deter drug dealing, cracking down ended up disproportionately impacting young black and brown males who often lack adequate legal representation and fill our prisons serving big time for small drug sales. The immediate goal needs to be saving lives. The Biden administration has proposed prioritizing harm reduction measures to save lives over harsher punishment. And that's why so many jurisdictions, 40 states, including Kansas and Missouri, have adopted so-called Good Samaritan laws to provide immunity from criminal prosecution for certain crimes for a person who is either experiencing an opioid-related overdose or observing one and calls 911 for help. Another harm reduction measure is to make naloxone, the opioid overdose antidote known by the brand name Narcan, widely available. Naloxone administered within a short window of time saves lives. Missouri schools, businesses and emergency responders should have the antidote available. Training for administering it needs to become as common as CPR. More funding is also needed to increase treatment for those struggling with addiction. And Missouri and Kansas lawmakers should legalize cheap fentanyl home test strips that both states currently outlaw as drug paraphernalia.
Paraphernalia.
Paraphernalia. This story was originally published September 9, 2022, 5 a.m.
Next article.
Missouri has one of the lowest COVID vaccination rates in the U.S. Get your booster, KC. Fall festival season with its fun and crowds is here, and so is the latest subvariant of the ever-present coronavirus. The good news is, there's a shot for the latter available free to anyone who wants it. On Wednesday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized two new COVID-19 boosters, available as early as this week. With children back in school, workers back on site and a broad loosening of pandemic protections everywhere, those who can get the vaccine should. Shots of the updated boosters, specifically designed by Pfizer and Moderna, target the BA.4 and BA.5 Omicron subvariants in a single shot. The Pfizer booster is authorized for ages 12 and older. Moderna's shot is for people 18 and up. On Thursday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices followed up with a recommendation of the boosters. We know, from the experiences of the last 2.5 years, that a shot in the arm is the best protection we have against the spread of this virus, which continues to mutate. We also know it is not the only way to fight against spreading COVID-19, which, make no mistake, is very much still among us. Last week, there was an average of 170 new cases each day in Kansas City, and nearly 1,400 in Missouri.
Next article.
Allegations of racism keep dogging this Kansas college. Time for a leadership change. Change can be slow, but in some cases patience is necessary. 2 years ago, we called out the unfair policies that singled out black student athletes at Highland Community College in Highland, Kansas, including allegations in a federal lawsuit filed by a former women's basketball coach and two assistants. In 2020, the school settled other claims made by four black student athletes that high-ranking school officials discriminated against them based on race. The school paid the four students roughly $12,000 to $15,000 each to settle the case. It also agreed to new mandatory anti-discrimination training for security officers and other campus staff members. Then there was the incident in February when school president Deborah Fox apologized for seemingly praising Adolf Hitler's leadership skills and comparing his negative influence to that of a black football player's negative influence on his team. We called for Fox to resign after the Hitler comments, arguing that a change in leadership was necessary. Finally, some evidence of that change is surfacing. Fox confirmed in an email to the board Monday that athletic director Brian Dorrell has resigned. Dr. Dorrell recently had the opportunity to pursue other interests and made the decision to resign from Highland Community College, Fox wrote, to give the school its best chance to rebuild its reputation as a place fair to students, players and coaches of all races. We urge Fox to consider again her own resignation. She told us she has no plans to do so, noting her contract runs through June 30, 2024. Efforts to speak about her job performance with Chairman Tom Smith of the Highland Board of Trustees were not successful. Nor were attempts to reach Dorrell for comment. But the string of race-tinged controversies on her campus, where she was hired in 2019 and quickly appointed Dorrell the same year, should have been enough for trustees to understand the need for leadership change. Dorrell will become an associate professor in the Health, Physical Education and Recreation Department at Chadron State University in Nebraska, the school announced this week. The allegations in the former basketball coach's lawsuit are serious. They began with a complaint to the NAACP around the time the school fired women's basketball head coach BJ Smith and two assistants, alleging academic violations that were never later substantiated. In February, the former coaches sued in federal court, alleging that Fox, Dorrell and trustee Russell Karn instructed coaches in football and women's basketball to recruit more kids that fit the culture of Highland, a city with a minority population of about 13%. Coaches who fought to protect the rights of black athletes were forced out, Smith and the two assistant coaches allege in the suit now pending in the U.S. District Court in Kansas City, Kansas. All three school leaders have denied the allegations made in the lawsuit.
Next article.
Kansas City is heading for another homicide record. What will end no snitch culture? No snitch culture. Tanisha Hinton of Kansas City is the mother of a murdered child. Her daughter, Shaira Hinton, was weeks away from turning 28 when she was fatally shot July 17th. Despite a reward of up to $25,000 for information leading to an arrest in the case, her murder remains unsolved. Part of the problem, according to her mother? A no-snitch culture in Kansas City that enables killers to remain free. When homicides go unsolved in Kansas City, we're all at risk, Tanisha Hinton wrote on a GoFundMe page she created asking for financial support to help her move from the home located near where her daughter was killed. Recently, Hinton announced on Facebook she had secured a new place to live. Her news came as Kansas City recorded its 110th homicide of 2022, a 10% jump in homicides compared to the same time last year, the second deadliest in the city's history. The motivations for the homicides we have experienced over the last year have generally not fallen into any identifiable cause or groups of causes which did not previously exist. In 2021, 75 of 157 homicides were cleared, according to Kansas City Police. Anti-crime advocates say Kansas City doesn't offer a program to keep witnesses safe if they do provide information on violent crimes. That's a problem because the people most often affected by violent crime often have the least faith in the criminal justice system. And many don't trust Kansas City police.
Next article.
Mike Parson is talking to Sam Brownback's tax experiment architect. Beware, Missouri.
Beware,
Missouri.
Beware, Missouri.
Beware,
Missouri.
Missouri Governor Mike Parson has called a special session of the state legislature, asking it to consider permanent income tax cuts that would cost the state about $700 million a year or more. The session begins September 6th, Right after Labor Day, we urge lawmakers to approach Parson's plan with extreme caution and skepticism. A permanent tax cut could cripple Missouri's budget in future years, threatening education, health care, public safety, and a host of other essential services. Parson and other Republicans don't see any danger. They point to an end-of-year surplus of $4.9 billion, a record built on higher incomes, more sales tax collections, and federal grants. "We believe that the state can pay the bill," Parson said last week. But reality is more complicated. Some of that end-year surplus will actually be used over the next several months on state programs, pension payments, and debt. The governor's own budget, issued earlier this year, projected a $1.6 billion ending balance in July 2023, less than a year from now, any tax reductions. If a recession hits and jobless claims grow, that surplus could shrink further. Additionally, some of this year's $4.9 billion surplus was built on federal spending enhancements for Medicaid, which are not permanent.
Next article.
Kansas City needs affordable housing now. Plan to link help to November vote is risky. No wonder folks who've struggled to find affordable housing in Kansas City don't trust that city leaders are making it a priority for low-income families, including the working poor who teach our children, staff our stores, or wait on us in restaurants. Mayor Quinton Lucas recently unveiled a proposal to ease requirements to build affordable housing for private developers who get tax breaks for their projects. The proposal will eliminate requirements that new projects include housing for the very low-income residents, instead allowing developers to focus on residents who can afford rents closer to market value. To address those left-behind residents, the mayor's plan is relying on a $50 million bond that will add money to the city's housing trust fund over several years, if voters approve it, for very low-income workers. Making it even dicier, the plan has been rushed through the city council without adequate public debate or a full airing of the details. Lucas told the editorial board this month that the pace is dictated in part by the calendar. The vote is in November, but the council must decide by August 30th if it wants the bond proposal on the ballot, which will also include a second question authorizing $125 million in city borrowing for infrastructure improvements. He's right about the tight timing, but he could have built in more time had he not waited so close to the deadline to propose the changes. That is partly why advocates for low-income housing have been outraged. Trust fund money could take 5 years. Even if the money is approved, the city has yet to detail how it will be used and how quickly the money would be borrowed. The terms of the bond election state only that the funds will be drawn down over 5 years. That's in keeping with what remains a bare-bones outline for the city's plan for affordable housing in general. It has set a goal of 10,000 affordable housing units by 2027, and has pledged funds already committed to the trust fund to build roughly 500 units per year over the next 5 years, including 14 projects approved this summer. Federal COVID-19 relief funds are earmarked to build 4,000 units. That leaves 2,000 units dependent on the $50 million bond voters will be asked to approve, with the balance depending on private fundraising. But how fast that money will be spent, and on what kinds of housing, isn't yet set. People facing a housing crisis need a roof over their heads now. Asking them to wait possibly 5 years before construction starts prolongs the hardship. That hardship affects residents up and down the income ladder. Even workers earning nearly $50,000 a year can struggle to find housing suitable for their families. At least 30 city jobs don't make enough to afford $1,200 rent, the rate set for a one-bedroom apartment, said Wilson Vance of KC Tenants, which has battled the city for years over a lack of affordable housing. That's why so many joined housing advocates at City Hall recently to protest the mayor's plan.
I think I'm gonna call Paul. Ten or more than sitting around smoking that stuff and drinking that hard liquor now. I've been living in the city since the day I was born. I've seen good times come and go and seen bad times drag on. Seen white and black folks alike get treated just like sin. Every year or so, see a new truckload of white trash moving in. When I was 16, I had a little trouble with the law. I said, boy, come here. I said, boy, yourself, I ain't done nothing wrong. Grab me by the arm and went upside my head. Nobody saw nothing, but I got a little
to find home. Took so much to keep both the going eyes always out and gone. Came home one afternoon to get me a change of clothes. Caught a quick walk and slipped off the guitar picker heading out my back door. Not a word got spoke, not a lick got throwed, and my woman ain't come back yet.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic.
Joe Biden stood in front of Independence Hall and gave one of the most disgusting and decisive speeches in American history, a speech that was laughed at and mocked by nearly everyone except for the lefty.
How nice. That's the Proud Boy.
Yeah, how nice. Get that gay shit out of here.
Yeah.
Faggot.
I was born in a Dublin street where the wild drums did beat. And those loving English feet, they walked all over us. Oh, and every single night when me pa would come home tight, he'd invite the neighbors out with this fine chorus.
Come out, you dark and hands, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Oh, and how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra.
Come tell us how you slew them old Adams two by two. Like the Zulus, they had spears and bows and arrows. Oh, how bravely you faced one with your 16-pound a gun. And you frightened them poor natives to the marrow.
Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Oh, and how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra.
Come, let us hear you tell how you slandered Great Parnell when you fought them well and truly persecuted. Where are the sneers and jeers that you loudly let us hear when our leaders of 16 were executed?
Come out, you blackened tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Oh, and how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra.
Oh, the time is coming fast, and I think those days are here when those English Johnny's heels will run before us. Oh, and if there be a need, then our kids will say Godspeed with a verse or two of singing this fine chorus.
Come out, you black and tan, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Oh, and how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra. Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Oh, and how the IRA made you run.
one like hell away. From the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra. From the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra.
From the green and lovely lakes of Kilishandra.
The dangers of ignoring the warnings about Trump would become clear in Charlottesville.
Demonstration by white nationalists at the University of Virginia.
A moment that would foreshadow what was to come.
Charlottesville was clearly a harbinger of the future, because it was an expression of the white supremacist part of the Republican base, and of what was stirring in the country that Trump had tapped into.
The next day, as neo-Nazis and white nationalists gathered, former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke invoked Trump's campaign.
We are determined to take our country back. We're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. That's what we believed in. That's why we voted for Donald Trump.
Some of the same characters and groups would participate in the insurrection on January 6th.
You have a president of the United States who is willing to give tacit approval to some of the darkest elements of American politics.
What candidate Trump and then President Trump and by default a number of leaders in the Republican Party did was give them space, was give them oxygen.
A man drives his vehicle into the crowd, killing Heather Heyer and wounding others. This was an incident that was clearly the tale of these far-right white supremacist powers emboldened and out of control.
And that was clearly one of the fundamental moments where you have to make clear what's right and wrong. There was no question about that.
So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was a horrible, horrible day. I think there's blame on both sides. And I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either. But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists. Okay. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
What about the Nazis who support you?
It's probably the first time where the country realizes this is going to get bad. And it is the beginning of a time in America where people realize that America is not just a place where racist ideals can exist, but it's a place where racist ideals can be fueled by the white hat, 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 by the white hat.
A tremendously positive impact on race relations.
Racism, the way that he flirts with racists, seemingly anybody who supports him is okay in his book, no matter what they believe.
Trump is on the phone with Paul Ryan and saying to the House Speaker, Paul, you don't understand me and you don't understand my political appeal. These are my people. I'm standing with my people. Ryan says, I don't care if they're so-called your people. You have to disavow the white national. Trump says, you don't get it, Paul. These are my people.
When Trump says that those are my people, he's not inaccurate. He knows who has been coming to his rallies and who has been lending support to him. And really, more implicitly, he's saying that these are our people, as in this is now the core of the Republican Party.
In Washington, Republicans were pressed to respond about Trump and Charlottesville.
It's a test. What are you going to do or say about this? Because all disagree with him and felt, in fact, were disgusted by it.
The hate and bigotry witnessed in Charlottesville does not reflect American values.
They all said, please, Mr. President, don't mention any names. So I won't.
It's about going back to the base, to the base, to the base, to the base, to demonstrate how
popular is be with the present.
Today at 4 p.m. was my arraignment. So my arraignment for the indictment of 7 felonies and 3 misdemeanors. At that arraignment, I was served with, before I walked in, I was served with a subpoena. Get this, Brandon. It's from Eric Coomer. Everybody knows who Eric Coomer is, right? And
well, for those who don't, tell us who he is.
So Eric Coomer is the, I won't even call him a gentleman. I will call him in Tifa. I will call him Dominion, the one that did the software that he bragged about.
This recorded message is brought to you by the National Socialist White People's Party. The swastika is calling you.
They're trying to kill me. They hate me. They just don't like women. Really? Who hates women? I've never met anyone who hates women.
Not yet.
Most men actually really like women. As far as I know.
Fuck democracy.
I want to see Antifa members hanging from gallows in Trump ties. That's what I would like to see. Yeah.
We need total dictator Trump. I seriously, and then, you know, there's no argument against it. Oh, the Constitution says this. It's like the Constitution is invalid.
Yes, the point of Christian nationalism, my goal is to break American democracy.
Here would be my solution. Elect a dictator, suspend the laws, dismiss the legislature, and the dictator taxes the people and uses the money to build a giant wall and uses the money to raise an army, that is personally loyal to him.
People need to be tried, convicted, and executed for treason.
The greatest example of love is to kill those traitors, so others learn never to do it.
We need to hold people with treason, start having some public hearings, and start executing people who are found guilty for their treasonous acts against the Constitution of the United States of America. Just like they did back in 1776.
There should be ministry tribunals taking place right now. And people should be arrested for high treason. That's been committed at the highest levels of government. Well, personally, I think if the firing squad just be great. Just put them all in, stick them up against the wall, and take them out.
What does a modern day militia look like? Because if you're like me, you see these guys got out with commies, and you're like, I want to shoot them in the face. But because you're like me, and you're a law-abiding patriot. You're not going to do that, because that's illegal. Or is it?
If for any reason the President of the United States feels that it's not getting done the way it should, and decides to put out the tweet that says, my fellow Americans, my fellow 2A loving Americans, it's time to take up arms, against these assholes. You are all fucked in under an hour.
We will then collect the power needed to silence, destroy, and imprison our political opposition. This fucking country is so gay. I hate this country.
My name is Matt Foley, and I am a former motivational speaker. Currently serving 3 to 5 years for non-payment of alimony.
We'll be right back.
for a joyride with my best girl, left me at the party. It was almost June, and the three-quarter moon illuminated the rain-soaked streets like a candy wrapper. I guess that's why Bobby had his lights off, driving them back streets of town and deserted country roads where me and Bobby used to tear ass so many times before. Sometimes with my best girl, sometimes Bobby had him one too. This night he banked that curve just a little too hard and that 442 went airborne, hit a telephone pole and split in two. Bobby's skull was split right in two, and my girl pinned in her seat, partially embedded in the dashboard. And for the next 20 minutes, the only sound of the night was the sound of her screams, the sound of the wheel still spinning. The next day at the graduation ceremony, everyone swore that when the paramedics got there, they could still hear Freebird playing on the stereo.
every film, I think, is, as I said, going into a new world, going into the unknown. But you should be not afraid of using your intuition and think your way through. Have the experience and trust your inner knowing of what it is. As cinema is such a beautiful language, and all of you all, you want to go back into, you have the gift of words. But cinema is a thing that deals with things beyond words, and it's so beautiful. And so to go with cinema is to go like the same kind of thing you go with music. But the intellect travels along with it. It's so fantastic. It talks to you, but not with words alone. So just go in open and just go in and have an experience in a different world. It's the most enjoyable thing to go into another world and discover it and make films. It's so beautiful.
And I've come to the conclusion that Stalin, like I said, unlike Hitler, was not a proactive revisionist, but was much more of an opportunist. If somebody was going to create the opportunities, he was going to seize them. He invented his own geopolitical theory. The socialism in one country was about socialism in one country first, because that's how history had happened. Should we build socialism in the one country in which it happened first on the way to socialism for the whole world? And the answer was, yeah, we're not give up the revolution of 1917. The socialism in one country first argument had been made by Lenin and had been made by Trotsky. And then it's made by Stalin. But Stalin created, because we have this Trotsky critique of Stalin's socialism in one country, which is not based upon what Stalin wrote. It was based upon what Trotsky said Stalin wrote in Socialism in One Country. Hitler is actually much more insane than Stalin in geopolitical terms, because Hitler doesn't calculate risk and reward the same way. Hitler is a gambler, a tremendous gambler, without calculating risk. He's much more like Lenin, Hitler, or Steve Bannon, for example, than he is like Stalin. Stalin is more calculating in his risk-taking, and less insane in risk. I mean, he's just as big a mass murderer, don't get me wrong. He's a sociopath, but I'm just talking in the geopolitical terms. So he's got this geopolitical theory, and he's living this geopolitical theory. So it's all about trying to not fly too close to the sun, but fly close to the sun. That's Stalin's geopolitics in the war period. And that, of course, is what worries the French and the British, in addition to the other things they're worrying about. So the idea of them doing a deal with Stalin against Hitler at any point is very difficult to fathom. Let's add the fact that Stalin is murdering loyalists. It's very hard to know. Is that kind of person going to keep his word, for example? We all now look back in retrospect and who thought Hitler would ever keep his word? But we're talking about Stalin keeping his word. Was that obvious that Stalin would keep his word? Was he the kind of guy that inspired trust? Stalin tries to negotiate with the Finns short of war. And the Finns just don't believe that he's sincere. He's making these sincere offers of territorial exchange. You give me this, I can protect Leningrad, I'll give you this. He's offering more territory, square miles, in exchange for the territory he wants the Finns to cede to him. And the Finns don't trust him. They don't believe him. He's got a credibility gap with the Finns because he's Joe Stalin. And the other things that he's doing, right, diminish your desire to take him at his word. So this is a major contributing factor to the outbreak of World War II. In addition, Stalin does have significant appetites. You see, because when he begins to take advantage of the Hitler-Stalin Pact in August 1939, the Hitler-Stalin Pact in August 1939 allows Hitler to destroy Poland. And Stalin takes that piece of Poland, right? He takes the eastern piece of Poland as part of the deal. But then Hitler goes and fights his war in the West and beats France in 6 weeks, and we all know that story. But in the meantime, Stalin has decided to annex the Baltic states, annex Bessarabia and Bukovina from Romania. And these things are not granted by the pact with Hitler. These are steps that Stalin takes. Additionally, they don't say anything about, you can annex and create clone regimes. So Stalin's appetite begins to grow in this process of taking advantage when Hitler's delivering these things to him. And so his Opportunism is very significant, but his opportunism is not driving the story. But it begins to drive the story in his fight vis-a-vis Hitler. Right? So what the hell was Hitler doing? What was Hitler up to? If Stalin was this opportunism whose appetite's in the eating and Hitler provided the opportunity, if Stalin was the one who scared the French and the British legitimately, as he did with the Finns, he contributed to the destabilization and the onset of World War II, even though he didn't think he was doing that, right? What about the Hitler piece? And here, this is just a fantastic story. So Hitler believed in the master race theory. He believed that the German master race could only survive in a zero-sum world if it destroyed the other empires. It had a destroyed Jewry, of course, but it couldn't survive if the British Empire endured. Now, we think of this as, huh? Right? There was a lot of world to divvy up. Hitler won the Second World War. He had the entire continent either under his control or direct control or loyalist to him. There were only two neutral countries. The Soviet Union was observing the pact with Hitler, and Britain across the channel had no beachhead on the European continent and no ability to cross and land on the continent and dislodge Hitler. So Hitler had won the Second World War as of 1941. You would think this would be enough. Napoleon hadn't achieved this. Take my word for it. Hitler had won the Second World War. But it wasn't enough. And it wasn't enough because he believed in this master race, zero-sum, social Darwinist idea, which meant that he had to prepare for war to destroy the British Empire, which meant to destroy the Americans as well, because certainly the British would rely on the Americans would help the British out. And in the meantime, the Soviet Union had to be destroyed because he needed the resources to take on the global British Empire. So Hitler's grand strategy was to destroy the Soviet Union, Britain, and the United States. That's what he was preparing for. And you say to yourself, my God, that's insane.
Woke up sunny side down, I still thinking I'm too proud to flip her over. Twin champagne hand jobs and the kissing ass I ever wanted involved. Well, cocaine rich comes quick, and that's one of the small bits of it all. Told me to try at the bottom if it really is one. They always told me when you hit it, you know it. But I've been falling so long, it's like gravity's gone and I'm just floating. Two things ain't the reasons for the bruises on your soul you've been neglecting. You'll never lose your mind as long as your heart always reminds you where you left. Don't ever let them make you feel like saying what you want is unbecoming. If you're supposed to watch your mouth all the time, I doubt your eyes would be above it. I'll meet you at the bottom if there really is one. They always told me when you hit it, you'll know it. But I've been falling so long, it's like gravity's gone and I'm just floating. Told me when you hit it, you'll know it. But I've
I've been falling so long, it's like gravity's gone and I'm just floating. I've been falling so long, it's like gravity's gone and I'm just floating. I've been falling so long, it's like gravity's gone and I'm just floating.
Pain I'm so to bear. No more words about pain. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. We got a lot of music this part of the podcast. We're touching a little bit on the railroad strike. Newsmax host is shocked to learn from a railroad worker that they don't get paid time off. Ad for a criminal defense attorney in Dallas. Kev got you covered. Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings' grandson. We've got Drive-By Truckers, Sons of Bill featuring Jason Isbell, Southern Accent, Ghost Riders in the Sky, Cowboy Prayer, Rebel, performed by Sons of Bill, Jackson, David Lynch talks about his film Mulholland Drive, Mel Brewer at the Real News Network Labor Day Conference asked the question, is the U.S. headed for a rail strike, with Max Alvarez. You can catch the complete live stream on YouTube at the Real News Network. Hobo Blues by John Lee Hooker, guitar lesson at nikrokris.com, that's N-I-K-R-O-K-I-R-I-S. Check him out on YouTube.
I was a highwayman. On the coast roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a maiden lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier spent his lifeblood on my blade. Them bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive. I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn in New Mexico. I went aloft and furled a mainsail in a blow. And when the yard broke off, they said that I got killed. But I am living still. I was a dam builder across the river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. A place called Boulder on the wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that great tomb that knows no sound. But I am still around. I'll always be around and around and around and around and around and around. I fly a starship across the universe divide. And when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again. Or I may simply be a single drop of rain. But I will remain. And I'll be back again and again and again and again.
A guy on Twitter just revealed software that can take an Instagram photo and use AI to search open cameras in a location to see if they can find the video of you taking the photo on that day. So the guy who created DieWith just unveiled this software where you give it like the Instagram photo on the left, and on the right you see this AI searching through a bunch of open cameras all around the world to see if they can find the people in the photo with the proper location and give you the video of the photo actually being taken. This must have been so hard to put together. The effect is fantastic, and it's a great way to remind people that you are constantly being watched, and so much more of your information is out there than you think. This is dope and terrifying, 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 terrifying.
What do you do if the police tell you to unlock your phone? First ask, do you have a search warrant? Chances are they probably don't, or they wouldn't be asking you. You tell them, I don't consent to any search. Ask for a lawyer and don't say anything else until you talk to them. Now, if you're a minor, tell them to call your parents. Remember, you'll hear them say, Kev got you covered.
I recorded one of Tom Petty's songs. It's a southern anthem, and I think it's a better one than Dixie. It's called Southern Accents. There has a southern accent where I come from. The young'uns call it country, the Yankees call it dumb. I got my own way of talking, and everything is done with a southern accent where I come from. Now that drunk tank in Atlanta was just a motel room to me. Think I might go work Orlando if them orange grows on free. I got my own way of working, and everything is done with a southern accent where I come from. For just a minute there I was dreaming, for just a minute it was all so real. For just a minute she was standing there with me. There's a dream that I keep having where my mama comes to me, and she kneels down over by the window, and she says a prayer for me. I got my own way of praying, and
reach out to the Association of American Railroads, and they say that workers get sick days and paid time off. But what I want to talk to you about is, what does this mean for Americans if you do go on strike?
Whoever told you we get sick days is manipulating the data. We get paid time off that we earned the previous year before. Before the new policy came about, we were allowed to take 5 days off and 2 weekend days off a month. Now we could take virtually one day unpaid off a month, and then the only other time we could take off is our paid time that we had to earn the previous year.
Yeah, that does seem ridiculous. They would never let airline pilots do that. Is that issue number one for members of the
100%
union?
100% is number one. And if we go on strike, yes, it could hurt the economy. It could be bad for society, but...
It's a huge political hot potato because nobody wants the strike to interfere with an already fragile economy, and a strike could spike the inflation rate. So that once you get that shortage of goods, when cars were in short supply, all of the car dealerships just jacked up the price of these cars. When you don't have enough computer chips, you just spike the price of those different products. So a strike in this sector could raise grain prices, could raise fertilizer prices, could any of the materials that are shipped by rail could go up. Estimates from the rail companies is $2 billion per day.
Riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged sky and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made. The horns were black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. He saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-yi! Their eyes were blurred, their shirts all soaked with sweat. He's riding hard to catch that herd, but he ain't caught him yet. Cause they've got to ride forever on that range up in the sky, on horses snorting fire, as they ride on, hear their cry. As the riders loped on by him, he heard one call his name. Save your soul from hell, riding on our range. Cowboy, change your ways, today are with us, you will ride. Trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies.
Make it clear that they were lied to again and again and fraudulently induced to board the plane. They were told there was a surprise present for them and that there would be jobs and housing awaiting for them when they arrived. This was obviously a sadistic lie. Not only did those responsible for this stunt know that there was no housing and no employment awaiting the migrants, they also very intentionally chose not to call ahead to any single office authority on Martha's Vineyard so that even the most basic human needs arrangements could be made, ensuring that no help awaited the migrants at all was the entire point. They were provided with a cartoonishly simple map of Martha's Vineyard and the United States and a brief brochure containing snippets from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts website and instructions to change their address with USCIS when they relocated. This is especially troubling as anyone with even the most basic understanding of the immigration proceedings knows that USCIS was not the agency with whom the migrants would have to record their addresses and has nothing to do with their cases in any way. It is clear that this was an intentional attempt to ensure that these migrants were removed in absentia when they failed to change their address with the proper agency. This was a purposeful derailment designed to prevent people from complying with federal immigration policies. This is problematic because the state should not be interfering with federal immigration policy. Before they boarded the planes, the migrants were processed by agents of the Department of Homeland Security, who listed falsified addresses on the migrants' paperwork. Agents apparently chose random homeless shelters all across the country, from Washington to Florida, to list the migrants' mailing addresses, even when told by the migrants that they had no address in the U.S. According to the paperwork provided to them, the migrants are required to check in with ICE office nearest to the fake address chosen for them by DHS or be permanently removed from the United States, with some required to check in as early as this coming Monday. It could not be clearer that this is an attempt to ensure that these people are ordered removed even as they try as hard as they can to comply with the instructions provided to them. There is no other reason to list as someone's mailing address a homeless shelter in Tacoma, Washington, when they ship him to Massachusetts. It is sickeningly cruel, throwing obstacles in the way of people fleeing violence and oppression, some of whom walked through 10 countries in the hopes of finding safety. It is shameful and inhuman. Many of these victims were deprived of medical care despite clear existing injuries. These are human beings who were deprived of basic human rights. To the people who find themselves, these wonderful people who find themselves plane wrecked on our island, I have a message for all of them. You are not alone. We are proud to be here for you.
Lord, I never lived where churches grow. I love creation better as it stood. The day you finished this so long ago and looked upon your work and called it good. I know that others find you in the light that sifted down through tinted window panes. And yet I feel your presence here tonight in this dim, quiet starlight on the plains. I thank you, Lord, that I am placed so well, that you've made my freedom so complete, that I'm no slave to whistle, clock, or bell, nor weak-eyed prisoner of Waller Street. Just let me live my life as I've begun, and give me work that's open to the sky. Make me a partner to the wind and sun, and I'll never ask a life that's soft or high. Let me be easy on the one that's down. Let me be fair and generous with all. I'm careless sometimes, Lord, when I'm in town, but never let them say I'm mean or small. Let me be as big and as open as the plain, and as honest as the horse between my knees. Clean as the wind that blows behind the rain, swift as the hawk that circles down the breeze. And forgive me, Lord, if sometimes I forget. You know about the reasons that are hid. You understand the things that gall and fret. You know me better than my mother did. Just keep an eye on all that's said and done. And turn me right sometimes when I turn aside. And guide me on that long, dim trail ahead that stretches upward towards the great divide. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie. These words came low and mournfully from the pallid lips of a youth who lay on his dying bed at the close of day. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie, where the coyotes howl and the wind blows free, without a soul to care for me. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie. Oh, bury me not, and his voice failed there. But we took no heed to his dying prayer in a shallow grave, just 6 by 3. We buried him there on the lone prairie. Thank you. I love American folk songs. They tell you the truth, you know. True stories, sometimes not always a happy ending. If it's not, they tell it that way. So I love it that way.
Yeah. father's father, they called us all rebels. But they burned down our cornfields and left our cities level. I can still feel the eyes of those blue-bellied devils as one round tonight through the concrete and the metal.
Why is that? Well, part of it is because of the good people of Kansas who showed them just where America is on this. America is a country committed to individual freedom and the rights of the people to make their own decisions and not having busybody theocrat politicians in state capitals telling them how to make their own decisions about their careers, about their lives, about their families, and about their health care. And certainly not allowing Lindsey Graham to dictate to the women of America what their destiny will be.
Here's my favorite entertainer, Mother Maybelle Carter's number two daughter. Here's June Carter.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson, I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson, look out Jackson town.
Well, when I breeze into that
that city, people gonna scrape and bow. All them women gonna make me teach them what they don't know how. I'm going to Jackson, you turn loose of my coat. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Yeah, we're going to Jackson. Ain't never coming back.
Honey, we got married in a fever.
Hotter than a pepper's fry.
Honey, we've been talking about Jackson.
Yeah.
Every film, I think, is, as I said, going into a new world, going into the unknown. But you should be not afraid of using your intuition and think your way through. Have the experience and trust your inner knowing of what it is. As cinema is such a beautiful language, and all of you all, you want to go back into, you have the gift of words. But cinema is a thing that deals with things beyond words, and it's so beautiful. And so to go with cinema is to go like the same kind of thing you go with music. But the intellect travels along with it. It's so fantastic. It talks to you, but not with words alone. So just go in open and just go in and have an experience in a different world. It's the most enjoyable thing to go into another world and to discover it and make films. It's so beautiful.
My friend, oh Lord. Well, oh boy, a great long ways from home, oh Lord. Hobo Blues by John Lee Hooker, and we will be wrapping up our series on the Mississippi Hill Country artist, which we started back with Mississippi Fred McDowell in June, and into fall we carried over onto R.L. Burnside, and we're going to wrap up with John Lee Hooker. I'll be presenting two lessons. This is in conjunction with my John Lee Hooker ebook, Volume 1, which is available for free on my website. If you locate the link on the information settings in a section on my website called Free Downloads, it's a PDF. It's very neatly organized in my ebook format, just to give you an indication of what my ebooks look like. So I thought it was important that we sort of dabble with John Lee Hooker, because his style is the artists R.L. Burnside and Mississippi Fragmentale, they're also influenced by John Lee Hooker. So I felt like he was the first in that area to gain wide notoriety and exposure. He became very popular ahead of the two other artists that I mentioned. The reason that I wanted to play this is because, A, it's an open tuning, and John Lee Hooker is also recycling and using some of the things that we've been learning these past 6 months, this past fall and summer. All of the links, the pull-offs, the bass runs, they appear in this song as well, and I wanted to put it all together for you to learn. Hobo Blues is an excellent song, definitely one of my favorite John Lee Hooker songs indeed. Before we continue, thank you again for all your support on subscribing to me on YouTube, liking me on Facebook. You're helping me on my mission to preserve this great music. So I'm happy to create this mini ebook that's free for download as a treat to all of you guys.
You all know, for the past 8 months here at the Real News Network, journalist Mel Buer and I have been extensively covering the long brewing crisis on America's freight railroads and all the different ways that corporate greed has wrecked the freight rail industry, supply chain, and has wrecked the lives of freight rail workers themselves. And, you know, trying to get mainstream media or DC politicians to care about this vital issue has been like pulling teeth, even though the issue has been going on for a very long time. The stalled negotiations between the major rail carriers and the 12 different unions that represent rail workers have been going on for over 2 years. Those negotiations officially reached an impasse in late spring of this year, after which President Joe Biden appointed a presidential emergency board, which in late August offered its recommendations for an agreement between the two sides. While the rail carriers enthusiastically supported the PEB's recommendations, workers have many misgivings. Frankly, things are moving very quickly. This video will probably be published on Thursday, less than 24 hours ahead of the strike or lockout deadline. And, you know, just this past weekend, ahead of the deadline for when lockouts could legally begin, the rail carriers began what many describe as a soft lockout by notifying customers and shippers of immediate carrier-initiated slowdowns and embargoed freight. Meanwhile, the union leadership in 10 of the 12 rail craft unions have reportedly agreed to accept recommendations made by Biden's presidential emergency board as the terms of a new contract, but the membership still needs to have their say and vote on it. And we just got word that the union representing signalmen decided to not even put the PEB up for a membership vote as the framework for a tentative agreement. This news is coming out quickly, and things may change by the time you see this video, but the relevance of the conversation we're going to have today is definitely going to last long after this week. Now, on Monday, Republican Senators Richard Burr and Roger Wicker introduced a resolution in Congress to adopt the PEB recommendations to avert a national rail strike, essentially forcing workers to accept a contract without having the chance to vote on it based on the recommendations of the Presidential Emergency Board. It remains to be seen if Biden and the Democrats are going to have more than that to offer a beleaguered railroad workforce that's been getting screwed for a long time and have pointed out that the supply chain is getting destroyed by corporate greed. And if workers themselves do not have the ability to strike, then they can effectively do nothing about this crisis. To talk about all of this and more, I'm honored to be joined today by my guest, Matt Parker. Matt is a full-time locomotive engineer who's been working on the railroads for 19 years. Matt also serves part-time as chairman of the Nevada State Legislative Board of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today on The Real News.
Max, I'm honored to be here, and thank you for having me here. Since 2006, I have served in various capacities with the union. Presently, I have served as chairman of the Nevada State Legislative Board for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen since 2013. What the railroads call precision scheduled railroading, I'm not going to justify it by calling it that. I'll call it Harrison railroading, because it has nothing to do with either precision or scheduling. Things that has come about as a result of that has been a massive reduction in the workforce now, which is having a detrimental effect on three things, really. It's having a detrimental effect on safety, it's having a detrimental effect on service, and it's having a detrimental effect on our working conditions overall. And really, with where we're at in this impasse right now, the feedback that I'm getting from the field is the dissatisfaction that the membership has with this has more to do with the working conditions than with pay and health care benefits, which are right up there at the top of the list also. Overwhelmingly, what I see is just the complaints about the working conditions, which, of course, the PEB kind of kicked that can down the road and addressed some of it, but said these are issues that we feel should be addressed locally. You know, they're not addressed for us. And really, I think that's at the heart of where we're at, this impasse that we're at right now. You mentioned the deregulation in the 1980s, and I think it's important to point out that was economic deregulation. The railroads are still very heavily regulated in terms of safety, but not so much anymore in terms of service. There was a lot of relaxation on that in that act in 1980 that economically deregulated the industry, and that was necessary to save a lot of the industry that was teetering on the edge of bankruptcy at that time. What we see today is that pendulum has swung the entirely other way, and it has become now a vehicle for Wall Street profit-taking from the railroads at the expense of service. Very evident from a number of hearings that have been taking place really since the fourth quarter of 2020, but particularly the Surface Transportation Board hearing earlier this year about service issues, where the four of the rail carriers, Norfolk Southern, CSX, BNSF, and Union Pacific, were all ordered to take certain steps to improve their service. You know, there was an acknowledgement there that there's a big service problem with the railroads right now. So that's one issue that we see right now, and that's something that a lot of people need to understand right now, is that the carrier's lack of attention to service is driving problems with the supply chain, and it's in part driving inflation. This is why it's important for them to know that, be paying attention to it, be concerned about it. They're paying more and having more difficulty in getting goods, because the railroads now, they're dictating the terms of service to their customers. They're not serving the customers. They're pretty much telling the customers, this is when you're going to get your freight, this is how you're going to get your freight. And the customers don't have any choice of what to do about it, because, as you said, the oligopolies that have been formed with these railroads now. At the time that economic deregulation was enacted in 1980, there were 45 Class 1 carriers in this country. Now we're down to 7, and that's likely to sink to 6 here, as it appears that the Surface Transportation Board is poised to approve the merger of CN and KCS. So if you're a rail customer and you don't like the service that you've got, in most cases you're a captive shipper, that you can't just take that business and go somewhere else. That's one thing that needs to be addressed. But again, it's been what we've seen through this Harrison railroading over the last 5-6 years, maybe a little bit more, is just cut, and that includes the workforce. And in these hearings and in all these discussions, the hearings in the STB, the hearings in Congress, we've got another one coming up on Thursday, by the way. Chairman DeFazio of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee has called another hearing to discuss possible service problems with agricultural product shipments during the harvest season. The railroads are blaming it on manpower, and as you pointed out, this is a situation they created themselves. They believed that they could cut their workforces to a certain level in order to reduce their expenses, to get their operating ratio down, and to reward their Wall Street masters more, and it has left them in this situation now where they don't have enough employees. More importantly, though, is that there's no sign that they're really taking any kind of serious action to correct that problem. And I honestly believe that what we're looking at here is incompetence of management, and the fact that these executives have now painted themselves into a corner with regard to manpower that they don't know how to get out of.
My name is Maximilian Alvarez. I'm the editor-in-chief here at The Real News. It's so great to have you all with us.
I'm freelance journalist and Real News contributor Mel Buehler, and Max and I are very excited to be co-hosting this special live stream here at The Real News. Right now, we in the U.S. are closer to a national rail shutdown than we've been in a generation. In this country, because labor relations on the railroads are governed by the Railway Labor Act, not the National Labor Relations Act, there are a lot more procedural hurdles that need to be cleared before railroad workers can legally strike and railroad carriers can initiate lockouts. As I've reported on multiple occasions in recent months for The Real News, we have actually cleared most of those hurdles, and we are standing on the edge of a potentially historic shutdown of the nation's freight rail industry. After years of fruitless negotiations between the major rail carriers and the unions that collectively represent around 115,000 workers, the two sides officially reached an impasse in the late spring of this year. Then the National Mediation Board stepped in to try to broker an agreement between the two sides, but that mediation was unsuccessful, and the board declared negotiations at an official impasse on June 14th. That triggered a 30-day cooling-off period. Then President Joe Biden appointed a Presidential Emergency Board, or PEB, in an effort to resolve the dispute. On July 14th, when the PEB was announced, the White House stated that the board would, quote, provide a structure for workers and management to resolve their disagreements. The board will investigate this dispute and, within 30 days of its establishment, deliver a report recommending how the dispute should be resolved. Then, in late August, the PEB released its 124-page report detailing recommendations for how the freight railroads and unions should structure an agreement to resolve the dispute. Both sides have the ability to reject the PEB's recommendations, and if they do, we will have cleared the final hurdle before a strike could be initiated. We're going to be breaking down the PEB recommendations with our guests today, but I guess we shouldn't bury the lead, and we should just let you know up top that the railroad carriers have enthusiastically endorsed the PEB recommendations. Railroad workers, however, are pissed, and we think you should know why.
You know, what happens now and what's been happening on to the railroads and to the railroads for years directly affects all of us. And yet, if you only watch corporate media, you might only be hearing about this for the first or maybe the second time. And chances are you have not gotten the essential background context that you need to understand how and why we ended up here. That's why here at The Real News, we've been committed to providing y'all with continuing coverage of what's happening on the railroads and to bring you the voices of the people who know that industry best, the workers. This is obviously a editorial commitment for us here at The Real News to lift up the lives and voices and struggles of our fellow workers. And a new scheduling and availability policy at BNSF Railway, which is owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which is owned by Warren Buffett. And, you know, this policy, according to workers, you know, as they were telling me back in January, would separate them from their families and make it next to impossible to live and reasonably plan their lives. And the BLET National President Dennis Pierce and SMART-TD President Jeremy Ferguson even called BNSF's quote-unquote high-vis policy, quote, the worst and most egregious attendance policy ever adopted by any rail carrier, end quote.
Yeah, when I first started reporting on this issue back in May of this year, I went to Fort Madison, Iowa, to attend a sort of solidarity informational rally that was attended by some rail workers, but a lot of retirees. Jeff Kurtz put it together, and we'll, you know, you'll meet him here in a moment. Just to kind of draw attention to just how much damage this attendance policy was having on the workforce, right? You know, modestly attended, about 40 people showed up. We listened to a lot of really great speeches from workers and union officials across the spectrum in terms of Iowa labor, which was really cool to see. And in the course of those conversations, I started to get a sense of just how unreal just these policies have been on the workforce and ultimately on the supply chain, right? The supply chain is a vast sort of vascular system of trade in both domestically inside the country and outside of the country. And it kind of relies on every piece working exactly as intended. Trucking, whether that's the moving of freight on the rails, whether that's shipping coming in from outside of the country into the country, or just moving items and goods and the various from within our borders in order for us to get our economy moving. When one thing falls off, it causes bottlenecks across the entire system. And so what we were seeing was, you know, this overburdened workforce of rail workers who take their jobs extremely seriously. They, you know, they understand exactly what part they play in this, you know, larger sort of economic sustainment in this country, right? And they're being driven into the ground, you know, like blood from a stone, right? And, you know, I've listened to workers talk about these attendance policies and, you know, just the years of this contract negotiation causing such strife and problems. And what ultimately ended up happening is it's affecting the supply chain all the way across the board. You know, shipping containers can't come to the ports if there's no space at the ports. You know, they have to be offloaded onto freight. And, you know, trucking companies have tried to pick up the slack, but there's only so much you can do, right? So when one thing fails, it causes problems all across the board. And the reality is that the rail carriers are shooting themselves in the foot doing this, right? They are the major cause of quite a bit of this, right? And what it comes down to is that this is what the unions are really pushing to make sure that their workforce is not going to continue to be overburdened by rail carriers who are making billions of dollars in profit every quarter, right? It's just not going to happen. You know, my second piece of reporting was this continued sort of solidarity and informational rallies that have been held by the 13 rail unions as a way to continue to keep this narrative either in the news cycle or to inform the communities that this affects, right, and to give folks a chance to really sit down and understand how massive this issue is, right? And so I went to Galesburg, Illinois, and I got to meet a lot of really amazing workers and see some folks that I had seen from previous reporting that are now, you know, folks that I check in with regularly. And I got the same thing. This entire workforce is not gunning for a strike, right? They want to go back to work. They want to be able to work these jobs that they, you know, some of these folks are third and fourth generation workers who have been working on the railroads their entire lives, right? All they're looking for is, you know, the respect that they deserve. And the rail carriers continue to refuse to give it to them.
Quick housekeeping things. As people in the live chat have been saying, big shout out to Mel's cat, Peach, who's in the background. I also wanted to give a big shout out to our siblings across the pond, members of the RMT union who have been on a continued work stoppage. You know, they haven't done a continuous strike, but they've been doing targeted strikes. Rail workers in the UK are also going through a whole lot of crap. So please help amplify workers on the ground struggles from Baltimore to Bangladesh. You can donate now to keep our work going by heading to therealnews.com.
Thank you. swagger that can set the world at ease. Some believe it's God's own hand on the trigger and the ills of dumping water in the sea. Judging what they do or don't believe. Seems to me you'd have to have a hole in your own to point a finger at somebody else's sheep. Baby, in the phone and my body's gonna jump and life is gonna come through my skin. You take a gill up without the rest of me, it wouldn't matter if it did. The skeletons ain't got nowhere to stick them on it. Nobody.
T-Bone Slim's songs.
Plague o' wild, simply wild over me, although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me, and he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me. And I plainly saw we never could agree. But so I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the jailer, he went wild over me. When he locked me up and threw away the key. Oh, it seemed to be the rage to keep me in a cage. He went wild, simply wild over me. Now they go wild, simply wild over me. I'm referring to the bed bug and the flea. Oh, they murmur in my sleep. They disturb my slumber deep. They go wild, simply wild over me. Will the roses grow wild over me when I've gone into the land that is to be? When my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Well, then God, he went wild over me. Oh, when I knelt beside the throne on bended knee. Oh, when the angels heard me yell, they shot me down to hell, but they went